This is the first day of this December 2010 four-day Sesshin. And we're going to read from an anthology of different Zen masters' teachings from a book called Zen Essence. And it's translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. These are Chinese masters. And the first one is the one of the most important of the Chinese masters, Yuan Wu. Yuan Wu is considered the author of the Blue Cliff Record, a collection of koans. And in the back of this anthology, there is a little bit here, material about Yuan Wu. He was one of the three most illustrious disciples of Wuzhu. And there's a large collection of his talks and verses on Zen subjects and letters of Zen instruction. The letters of instruction, were collected under the title Essentials of Mind. And it is from this text that these selections here are taken. Just a little thumbnail sketch of Yuan Wu's teaching here by the editor, Thomas Cleary. Yuan Wu affirmed the expedient nature of Zen teachings and practices, which are not supposed to be fixed dogmas and rites, but means of helping people arrive at the source of mind and be free from illusions. This word expedient or expedient means is a good one to... It's one we come across quite often in Zen texts, and for good reason. It means that there's no abstract teaching. There is only the teaching of the teaching for this particular student at this time. There's no thing as such. There's no general teaching that is not specifically adapted to a particular student at the time. And that means expedient means can be just about anything that can help that particular student, which may not be helpful to another student, but it suggests that real Zen teaching is adapted to the particular student, or maybe in a group to a large number of students. And Cleary continues here, Zen is in you, Yuan Wu said. Its penetrating insight and profound calm always exist. I could also say, Zen is you. Even to say it's in you suggests an inside and an outside, or a container and a content. Its penetrating insight and profound calm always exist. Last week I gave a brief talk in the Zendo in Arnold Park about this very thing, that it's not like in Sesshin there is more of this self nature, or that we have to come here to get it. It is everywhere equal. Every moment is soaked in this enlightened nature, this essential nature. Inside Sesshin, outside Sesshin, doesn't matter. It's all exactly equal. It's just that when we're doing many hours of sitting a day, it becomes more accessible. But it's always with us. It is us. This essence. So how can we access it wherever we may be? He answers that. Look for the level of mind that is not dancing with objects and hanging around with things. Yuan Wu instructed. Clear the mind. Forget about subjective opinions and feelings. So this, of course, we all know that it is our thoughts, or more accurately, our attachment to our thoughts that prevents us from realizing this essential self-nature that is never apart from us. Like his teacher Wu Zu, Yuan Wu was highly critical of deteriorated Zen studies. He noted that many intellectuals and educated people study Zen as a hobby and conversation piece. This was a lot more common, I think, this debased Zen. It's not even a Zen, it's just this faux Zen. That was much more common when Zen was first appearing in the Americas, when Roshi Kaplow was studying with D.T. Suzuki after World War II. And then he said, Roshi used to say that you couldn't go to a cocktail party in New York, in Manhattan, without Zen koans being thrown around. And I don't see that so much. I haven't heard of that so much anymore. And then in the wider culture, now I see what seems to have replaced it is a commercialized Zen, which is all these Zen products that can be found everywhere and that seem to be multiplying as the years go by. Zen perfumes, Zen detergents, Zen chocolate chip cookies, Zen software, Zen every kind of thing. Zen was used as a status symbol. He's referring back to the time of Yuan Wu's China. Was used as a status symbol and became the basis for a great deal of snobbery because of its honored position in Chinese culture. Thus, Yuan Wu insisted on the right purpose and inspiration for Zen practice, particularly recommending the exercise of looking at death to clarify the will. I wish we were given some specifics about that. In Tibetan Buddhism, there is a practice, or maybe it's not Tibetan Buddhism, another kind of Theravadan Buddhism. There is a practice of contemplating death. Actually, it's probably in Tibetan Buddhism too. They have such a variety of practices, but it's a practice of imagining our body in a state of dying or death, as I've heard. In Zen, looking at death, really, we do that by looking looking at no thought. This is what death really amounts to in its essence. It's not being. It's seeing what is when there are no thoughts in the mind. It's a realm of emptiness. And this realm of emptiness is not apart from the world of phenomena. Just as death is apart from life only in the words we use. We set up this dichotomy, life on the one side, death on the other. When we reach a state of absolute stillness in the mind, this is basically death. No self. Self is gone. Because the self is just thoughts. What we call the self is just an amalgam of memories and ideas, images, and associations of the self. When we can get beyond that, then we are free of our attachment to our thoughts, attachment to the self. This phrase that he recommended, the exercise of looking at death to clarify the will, I have this memory springing to mind of a practice that we're told that the monks would sometimes do in China or Japan or both, of in order to stay awake, to combat drowsiness, they would sit up on the edge of a well. Focusing the mind. Well, that's all we have about Yuan Wu for now, and let's go to some of these selections of his teachings. An ancient Zen master said, now these are his own teachings, an ancient Zen master said that Zen is like learning archery. Only after long practice do you hit the bullseye. This is not something that beginners want to hear. You don't want to hear that it's going to take years to really develop real proficiency at this. But it's like anything of great value. It takes practice, long practice, to really get good at it. But reaching some arrival point is not the idea. It's working at it. People in martial arts know this. So long as we're hung up on achieving some state of mastery, then it's going to interfere with the real work. The same in Zen. We do the best we can at the time. We do the best we can with what we, the hindrances that have been dealt to us. And we're all in the same boat with this. No one just springs into Buddhahood as soon as they learn to do Zazen. You're tested. You have to find, uncover these qualities of character that are required for any mastery in anything. Patience, persistence, steadfastness. Taking the long view. No one who has achieved mastery at anything has done so overnight. Roshi Kepler used to quote a saying in Japan, it takes 3 years to find your seat, meaning to really get settled into your sitting. I think it mostly means posture. When I first heard that, I'd been sitting for a year or two, and I thought, oh, great, 3 years. 3 years is nothing in terms of this timeless vehicle of self-purification. I bet a lot of you know the story of the student, newcomer, who asked the master, how long will it take me to come to awakening? And the master said, 10 years. And the student said, 10 years? That long? And the master said, make it 15 years. And then the student became incensed. 15 years? I don't have that kind of time. The master said, for you, 25 years. It's not that the master in that story was each time seeing something new in the student. This was his expedient means for working with that student. He was trying to help the student understand that mind of impatience and almost like a sense of entitlement. It's a huge impediment to practice. Yuan Wu continues, enlightenment is experienced instantaneously, but Zen work must be done over a long time. Like a bird that when first hatched is naked and scrawny, but then grows feathers as it is nourished until it can fly high and far. It's a wonderful, wonderful analogy. When it comes to worldly situations by which ordinary people get suffocated, those who have attained Zen get through them all by being empty. Thus, everything is their own gateway to liberation. Worldly situations by which ordinary people get suffocated. Many of us can appreciate this term because our daily lives can so easily become so stressful and make us feel so boxed in or oppressed by the number of things we have to do and how little time we have for sitting. But sitting is just a small part of practice. There's all the rest, different forms of practice. And that's what he's addressing here. So how do we find our way through stressful circumstances at work, stressful circumstances in the home? By being empty. But what does that mean, being empty? It means not clinging to thoughts. Not dwelling in thoughts. To put it another way, it means getting out of the way. We're always getting ourselves in the way, putting ourselves in the way. Once we can refrain from clinging to thoughts, then there is no self in the way, there is just the way. The Tao. The way things are. When it's cold, it's just cold. Not, I'm cold. Why am I cold? Why do I have to put up with this cold? Or when one is drowsy, there's just the drowsiness. You don't have to personalize it, make a big issue out of it, wrap it around the self. Just drowsiness, just drowsiness. Thus, he says, thus everything is their own gateway to liberation. It's all grist for the mill. All of the trying circumstances of our daily lives, the quarrels we may get into with people, all of the issues that come up for us with others, that's all grist. It's all practice. It's all a chance to practice letting go. Here's another selection that offers an example of this. He says, if people find fault with you and try to put you in a bad light, wrongly slandering and vilifying you, just step back and observe yourself. Don't harbor any dislike, don't enter into any contests, and don't get upset, angry, or resentful. Well, it's much, much easier said than done, isn't it? When someone is wrongfully bad-mouthing you, to not react, this is awfully, awfully difficult. This takes years of practice. But we can, through years of practice, come to regard this kind of mistreatment, verbal disparagement and all, we can come to understand it as not really anything we need to react to. Reacting to it is not likely to help things. That's what... That's the this kind of reacting is the the engine behind the conflicts and wars in the world. No, reacting isn't going to do much, or it'll do too much. It'll just compound the tensions, the problems, and provoke a reaction in the other person. No, we have to in such situations draw on faith in something beyond acting and reacting. He says, just cut right through it and be as if you never heard or saw it. Eventually, malevolent pests will disappear of themselves. If you contend with them, then a bad name will bounce back and forth with never an end in sight. Probably everyone can appreciate the wisdom behind this, but how many of us can apply it when we're on the ropes and someone is saying bad things about us or to us? Now, this doesn't mean that we just roll over every time someone wants to beat up on us. There's a place for responding. But what he's talking about is something where you try that first. You try to respond, not react emotionally, but to respond in a way that will show the other side or point out the mistake in what the person is saying. But you know, there comes a point where defending yourself is just a lost cause in these situations. That's when you just have to exhale and have faith that this attack will run its course and you'll be no worse for it. What he says is it's a reacting that will make you worse for it. But all of this these are just words until one really has to face these situations. And then, I think for a lot of us, it's just making the mistake of reacting and defending oneself and getting all wrapped up in it and finding again and again that that doesn't work. It doesn't really do any good. That's when you just learn to unplug from the whole dynamic of defending. Here's another selection. Cut through all situations and don't allow yourself to continue with thoughts of whether these situations are favorable or adverse. Eventually, you will naturally reach the realm of non-doing and unconcern. Cut through all situations. So, same thing, just said in a different way. How do you cut through all situations? You refrain from clinging to thoughts. Don't allow yourself to continue with thoughts of whether these situations are favorable or adverse. Well, we get good training in this in Sesshin. There are plenty of adversities that we have to meet up with. We meet up with in Sesshin. And if we're framing them as adverse, it's what we don't like, then we're caught. And it's in terms of how our practice is going. This is what people can spend just way too much time labeling their state of mind as, oh, it's good now, or it's not so good now, concentration is better, oh, now it's worse. This is folly. This is what hangs us up in practice, is dwelling in these notions. Eventually you will reach the realm of non-doing and unconcern. It's detachment. We grow into detachment from ups and downs, better and worse, good and bad. That's a mature practice. When we don't care what the state of our mind is at any given time, we notice it. We notice if our attention is flagging, if we're not very concentrated. We notice it, and we drop the thoughts that are getting in the way, but we don't make a case out of it. And then he finally says, but if you have the slightest desire for unconcern, this has already become a concern. That's a stage that some people go through where they think that by being indifferent to the state of their practice, that that's the way to go. Indifference is not what we're trying to cultivate. Indifference means, oh yeah, whatever, who cares? It's a indifference, the way I'm using it at least, is distancing. It's sort of a helpless posture. Here's just one sentence selection. If you have the idea of superiority and are proud of your ability, this is a disaster. Well, this would seem to be just a part of Zen 101, not to be proud. But what makes this difficult to live up to is how many subtle forms of pride we can be feeling without noticing it. It's unusual for someone to be strutting around, bragging about oneself. That's very unusual in Zen. But the further we go in practice, the more we see how devious the mind is and how ingenious the mind is at finding ways to feel superior. And one of the most lethal of these is feeling that we have some special status because of how lousy we are in Zen practice. the mayor of New York many years ago, LaGuardia, would brag that when I make a mistake, I really make a mistake. There are basically two types of egos or self-images. One is based on the craving for existence. This is the Buddha's teaching. One is based on the craving for existence, and one is based on the craving for non-existence. Or we could say one is you're craving to be somebody. I could have been somebody. Could have been a contender. Or the other type is the craving to be nobody. To disappear somehow, to become invisible, to shrink where no one can see you. The first type, the craving for existence, is where you just want to inflate. You want to see the self inflated. And it's a losing proposition, because no matter how big and fat your sense of self becomes, it's never going to be, as long as you define it that way, it's never going to be big enough. There'll always be grasping for something more, some greater sense of accomplishment, achievement, possessions. And the other is wanting to annihilate the self. Often it's paired with hating, self-hatred. So neither is worse than the other. They're just two forms of egotism, two kinds of major hindrance. The latter kind, the second kind, the wish to annihilate the self, this often shows itself in practice with self-denigration, judging oneself negatively, finding fault with oneself as a pattern. Over and over and over again, we catch ourselves with these thoughts of denigration and comparing. This is just murderous for Zen practice, is comparing ourselves to others. Here's one last one for Yuan Wu. When you are aware of the completeness, fluidity, and boundlessness of central mind, how can sense objects be partners to it? That is, to reach this state of vast openness and clarity means to see all objects as one's own self, not as objects apart from oneself. The whole dichotomy of subject and object breaks down. How can sense objects be partners to it? basic mind, essential mind, is utterly free, open and pure, clear and ethereal. Keep thoroughly aware of it and do not allow superficiality. Then it is so high there is nothing above it, so broad it is boundless. Clean and bare, perfectly round, this basic mind is without contamination or contrivance. Perfectly round. What does this mean? He's talking about this mind of formlessness. So what does he mean by perfectly round? He means the mind of formlessness. Without borders, without boundaries, without limits. This basic mind is without contamination or contrivance. The Buddha said, This mind is bright and self-luminous, but it is stained by adventitious defilements. Adventitious means that which comes and goes, that which is not inherent to our nature. So this mind, this inherent mind, is bright, luminous, but it has these clouds that pass over it. But in its essential nature, it is unstained, perfect. That brings us to the end of this chapter, so we'll stop now and recite the four vows.